Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Experimentation with drugs and alcohol was long seen as a relatively harmless rite of passage for adolescents, but that thinking has changed as we see younger and younger children using substances, teens struggling with addiction, and tragically dying of overdose. Substance use in teens is not harmless. Our thinking about prevention and treatment for substance use in teens is also shifting. Today, we talk about regional programs for teens with substance use disorder and how collaborations amongst healthcare providers, schools, and behavioral health professionals can create opportunities for kids to thrive. Joining us, Daniel Rodriguez. He's director of substance use disorder and outreach programs at Duffy Health Center. Welcome back, Daniel. Good to see you.
Hello, Mindy. It's a pleasure to be here.
We have Stephanie Brietti. She's the co-founder of and CEO of Behavioral Health and Innovators. Welcome back to you, Stephanie.
Thanks, Mindy.
Angela Knapp, executive director of Martha's Vineyard Youth Task Force. Hi, Angela.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Rachel Merriweather's Director of Clinical Operations at Fairwinds Nantucket's Behavioral Health Center. Hi, Rachel.
Hey, Mindy. Thank you so much for having me.
So for those of us who aren't interacting with adolescents every day, as you all are, help us understand how pervasive substance use is in teens and even preteens. What are you seeing in your work, and what do we know from research and youth surveys? And Stephanie, why don't we start with you? How big of a problem is this?
Mindy, our data from the PASS program, which is the Positive Alternatives for Student Support program, indicate that of the 300 high school students that have gone through program, 68% are presenting with a substance use concern, 84% with mental health concerns, and 61% with both. And these are severe concerns that we have about their use. They come to program referred from schools. 17 different schools are sending to program. And I guess the most telling metric is of these high percentage of kids that have these significant issues, only 35% are coming to us having received services before.
Well, anybody want to add anything to what they're saying?
Daniel. So, Mindy, what I can add is we know that nationally, you know, statistics don't seem to be improving when it comes to substance use in adolescents and children. And another barrier to all of this is that standardized assessment of students and children, we don't quite know what the data set is because of the fact that we don't really have the best way to capture that in a meaningful way. So what we do know is that it is continuing to be a prevalent issue. You know, we've seen that also with, you know, schools reporting nicotine dependence with vapes, all those aspects. So it definitely continues to be a concern.
And go ahead, Rachel.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we've been noticing here, we're a CBHC, a community-based, we're a community behavioral health center, right? So we try to be all-encompassing based on what resources we have on the island. Our med management team, psychiatry, and our psychiatric nurse practitioners are really noticing with vaping and with access to cannabis in different forms, gummies, et cetera, that there seems to be this increasingly prevalent dependence, addiction symptoms are what are showing for our young people who are using the cannabis at this early age while they're still sort of wiring themselves and learning adaptive skills and learning coping skills. And because they're not legally able to get it, right, they're dependent upon someone else, which means it's not something they can go pick up like we would a prescription, mm-hmm. right, in pharmacy. Okay. So in those gaps between having access, we're really noticing these severe depressive states, psychotic states. Children are being hospitalized as a result. So this is something we've seen more and more over the past year here. Yeah. And it is directly related to the substance misuse.
Angela, same on the vineyard? Yeah.
Yeah, I would say one of the things that I can agree with Rachel about is that we are seeing this increase in isolated, so individual use of substances, not necessarily in a group setting. Chief Chris Dolby here in Edgartown has said there's been a significant decrease in calls for house parties because students are staying home and isolating themselves, connecting via social media, and using substances for coping a great deal of the time as compared to the majority previously or potentially being more related to connecting with others, it's part of that isolation that we're seeing.
So how early are kids beginning to use substances, and what are the most common substances that kids are trying first? What are the ages? Stephanie, what are you seeing? How young are we talking?
Fifth and sixth graders that are coming to the PASS program, and we've only begun that program as of October. A good 25% plus are already coming with a substance use
fifth and
concern.
Sixth graders. So we're talking like 11, 12 years old.
Yes.
Is that what everybody else is seeing?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yes.
And you know, Rachel, you brought up a good point. The brains are still developing, right? And you know, this obviously has an impact on that. When we were growing up, right, it was pot and alcohol. But the marijuana of today is not the marijuana that it once was. So talk about the potency of that today, and you know what these kids are being subjected to. Anybody?
We have the synthetic, you know, they're made to be geared toward and marketed to say, this will be great if you need to relax more, if you have anxiety. This will be great to actually sort of stimulate you if you need to focus. And we're hearing these descriptors of things that mirror what prescription drugs are typically used for. And we're hearing parents, this permissive culture, who will say, well, I don't want to put you know, drugs in my child. You know, I don't want to give them traditional, you know, Adderall or something prescribed, Ativan, whatever it may be, whatever would be prescribed traditionally by a doctor. But there's this misinformation that these parents are believing, well, this is natural. This is all natural. So if I take this gummy, that is this potency for an adult, but I section it off and just give a little bit of it, that will naturally help my child with this anxiety or with this focus problem. So that potency, and also the marketing that says this will help you with this, but in a natural way, is really been really a window into snowballing into what this has become.
Yeah.
And I would say also, it's not only the marijuana that's incredibly more potent, but the nicotine in vaping, right? One vape can have up to a pack of cigarettes worth of nicotine. So the level of addiction is different. And we're very fortunate to have research on Martha's Vineyard since 1999. And I would say I haven't seen a great trend in the permissive parenting, but what we do see is a lot of children accessing their substances through their parents. So that is one thing that we're really working on educating parents about.
I want to talk about vaping for a second. Vaping, relatively new, and I know that, especially my generation, are like, vaping, it didn't, you know, didn't exist. What, so describe what vaping is and why this is such a concern for people. Daniel, why don't you take that one?
Yeah, I can just start by saying, you know, similar to both what Rachel and Angela were discussing about how it's marketed and kind of the way it's currently in the community, is originally vaping was supposed to be designated as an alternative to cigarette use, right? So it was marketed as kind of a harm reduction approach for individuals who are chronic nicotine dependent folks. And it was supposed to be a healthier solution to smoking, which, as we know, is not the reality because, you know, again, the amount of nicotine that's actually in, again, these vape cartridges are definitely much more potent than, you know, a pack of cigarettes. That being said, is I think where we see trends continue is how these items have been marketed towards with an eye to younger populations. So, you know, I don't know any 60, 50, 40-year-old men in my network that are all about the tutti frutti flavored, you know, vapes. Yeah. I would sense that that would be for a younger demographic. I mean, a lot of the channels that, you know, nicotine vapes have been promoted in are surrounded or encompassed in kind of like adolescent childhood arenas, right? So what we see is not only we kind of have a trifold thing happening here. We have a substance, nicotine, that is coming in at a higher dose. We have this approach of targeting younger populations to show them that this is like the new cool trendy thing, and our adolescents and children see cigarette use as gross, right? We've been programmed to say cigarettes are gross, but look at this thing, which is vaping, which is clean. It's okay. It's not a problem. And then the third part of that is, it's been normalized. It's been brought into our culture as something that is fun and okay, and is not going to be a problem for you. So with all of that kind of coming and gelling together, the mixed messaging for our teens is that it's okay and safe to do this, when we know in reality that's not the case. And by the time, a lot of folks can provide interventions, our children have become physically dependent on these substances.
Yeah. What are the trends that we're seeing in alcohol use by adolescents? We mentioned marijuana and the vaping, but what about alcohol? Is that you're Rachel, you're nodding your head. What are we seeing about with alcohol use?
That for the island itself is for Nantucket is sort of an interesting dynamic. So as you know, we are a tourist destination. We have our summer crowd, we have the bonfires. And so we have this, that's that binge drinking culture that stayed steady. I haven't seen much of a deviation from that, but what is concerning is the poly substance use and abuse that comes into play in those situations. So when we have this easy access to vapes and whatever might be in that particular cartridge or vape, and we have the binge drinking culture that is also very permitted because that's our identity, right? We have a bonfire on the beach and everybody comes with in a Jeep and this is how we party, right? And they're happening at the same time. And again, both of those are legally accessible. It's not like when we're telling them, we know cocaine and we know methamphetamine and we know, these drugs that really could get you in trouble, really could get you arrested, really get the bad press. These are things that are really accessible that older brothers, cousins, et cetera, can get. But when we're looking at the trend in drinking, I'm actually seeing far fewer high school kids, I would say, accessing, looking for opportunities to binge drink. And have because it's not a they don't need that to be social and to feel that their inhibitions are down because they have all these other ways through their vapes that is more culturally cool and acceptable. So the concern for us is that poly substance that comes in with the
Stephanie?
drinking.
I would just want to second what Rachel said, but also point out that the impact on the teen who's both smoking weed or taking gummies and drinking at the same time gives them this, incapacity for an extended period of time. So a synergistic effect that makes it even more harmful.
And then, of course, we have fentanyl and opioids. What kinds of trends are we seeing in use and availability? How are the kids getting exposed to fentanyl?
So Mindy, if it's okay for me to take this one, and I just kind of want to step back and piggyback off what Rachel and Stephanie also shared. I think that what we also need to talk about when we talk about trends for adolescents around any substance use is what is the generational history attached to it? And we know that on Cape Cod and the islands, that alcohol use disorder continues to be the primary substance use disorder. And in Massachusetts, in the United States, that seems to be the kind of ongoing trend. So as we look at propensity of our children and our adolescents to come into contact with alcohol in a maladaptive way, right? It's already kind of there. So that is what leads many of our participants and our children into seeing alcohol as not a major problem or something that's socially acceptable. And what is lacking often is discussions around appropriate use, all of those things, right? So somewhere down the road here today, we'll talk about what we can do to support changes in this, but that kind of sets the stage, right? And then when we look at opioid use, I think that the trends over time have remained fairly level in the sense that there definitely are adolescents who are experimenting throughout their teens. That has been something that has happened for forever. But what we do know is that often opioid use doesn't seem to be taking place until I would say like adolescents are becoming a part of like an emerging adult's age range. So somewhere between like the 17 to 24 range is when that becomes more prevalent. And at that point in time, those individuals are seen less as emerging adults and more as just traditional adults. So you kind of don't see this age easy A to Z because of the fact that the age range and the service providers and all of that stuff kind of shifts. So the footsteps are being taken, and again, dabbling or trying or whatever it may be is kind of taking place throughout. And then as our teens are hitting the 17, 18, 19, is when we start to see some of those other use patterns escalate.
I'm not really up on all the drug culture, but can't we see some of like the marijuana laced with fentanyl? I mean, we hear stories about that. So there could be times when kids are using marijuana that they don't even know is laced with fentanyl, right? All right, go ahead, Rachel.
Yeah, this is a concern we get. We try to work closely just in reporting and knowing what's going on so that we can be prepared for it. But it'll say, oh, a new batch of marijuana, street marijuana, hit the Cape and it is laced. So we'll kind of get that message that will be sent to our police department and they'll communicate that to us so that we can have those conversations or look out for that. But a lot of we see an equal balance of deliberate access and then a lot of count for our younger crowd, not just, but in this subject matter for our adolescents. The counterfeit pills, at a party, it's a handful of pills from whoever's cabinet, and it's laced. It's got fentanyl in it, right? And so we see that. We have seen the marijuana have fentanyl with it, and I think that is a concern that we can possibly ring enough alarms about in every setting, in the schools, and in our mental health facilities, in every opportunity because. It's that once and done. It's the kid who's always been the good kid, right? Played sports and got A's and B's, but it's graduation. Like, let's go wild. Let's try a pill. That's the one.
And
It's
Mindy, if I may add to Rachel's comment, I would agree 100% in the sense that our risk area for a lot of our teens is around those pressed pills, right? They think they're going out, they think that they're purchasing, a stimulant something, a Ritalin, Adderall, whatever it is, and then it's not that. There is still some debate, full transparency around whether or not marijuana can truly be laced with fentanyl, given kind of the burn point in traditional smoking. So you get kind of two schools of thought of it can or it can't, but what we usually say is if we have had an adolescent experience an overdose and they're reporting that the only thing that they're using is marijuana, then we probably want to chip in a little bit further because most likely that's not the full story. So we just always want to be mindful not to take things at face value, at least in the work that we do with alternative peer group, because often we kind of start to chip away and notice that there is a more pervasive use history there opposed just to someone, smoking marijuana.
Go ahead, Stephanie.
Danny, we also do we not provide fentanyl strips to the teens at the APG program and educate them on the use of fentanyl strips?
Correct. Yes. Harm reduction is a major part, I think, of all the work that we do here on this call and being able to have open conversations about how we, reduce those risks.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about regional programs for teens with substance use disorder and how collaborations among healthcare providers, schools, and behavioral health professionals can create opportunities for kids to thrive. With us, Daniel Rodriguez, Director of Substance Use Disorder and Outreach Programs at Duffy Health Center. Stephanie Brietti, she's co-founder and CEO of Behavioral Health Innovators. Angela Knapp is Executive Director of Martha's Vineyard Youth Task Force. Rachel Merriweather's Director of Clinical Operations at Fair Winds, Nantucket's Behavioral Health Center. And also joining us now is David Alexander, Assistant Principal of Monomoy Regional High School. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. David Alexander, welcome to the program. I want to ask you, as educators, healthcare providers, and community members, how do we respond to substance use for teens? For a long time, it was, remember, the Just Say No campaign, maybe school suspension, arrest. How has the approach evolved, David?
Thanks for having me on. I mean, it's a tsunami of opportunity out there for kids to get a hold of things that were a lot harder to get a hold of when we were young. The thing that's changed the most, Mindy, is that schools, I've been in education for 30 years, there's more partnerships with outside agencies. Cape Cod Pass is a great beginning, but it's certainly not the end, because there's a litany of issues, drugs, social, emotional concerns, that kids, due to the crush of social media on top of the drugs that are out there, they're faced with just sort of an overwhelming amount of things that have been normalized that really shouldn't be, whether it's violence or any of these other kind of negative things that are out there. So schools are more willing and are putting time and people into positions that can then partner with groups like Cape Cod Pass, which is a critical part of our approach. But you have to keep going. For example, this year we hired a restorative justice coordinator who works with kids to, instead of suspending them, they have an opportunity to go through a restorative justice process where they then can talk with the people that have been harmed in whatever incident that they've been involved with in order to repair relationships. So it's important work. It's a lot of work, and you need time and funding to go along with it, because inevitably these are going to be the ways that we support our kids, and there's no way around that. So if people aren't on board with, I wouldn't even call it a progressive approach, it's a survival approach with all these things that are out there, then they're falling behind, and it's a disservice to our kids. So I'm thankful that the mindset has changed. There's less shame around owning all these different problems that are out there. Whereas in the past, before, you know, people would kind of, you know, not want to own or admit they were having these issues around mental health. So I could keep going, but yeah. I think I answered your question.
David mentioned the PASS program, Stephanie. So tell us more about the PASS program.
So the PASS program for high school started in 2022, and we are continuing through this school year. We've grown it by leaps and bounds because so many students are vaping in schools, and that's against school rules, and it tees them up for a suspension. But we went beyond that. Actually, it was Monomoy principal who requested that we open up PASS not just to kids facing suspension, but any kid that's identified as having a mental health or substance use problem. So they come to program. About 300 kids have gone through the high school program, as I mentioned earlier. What is kind of the golden nugget in the program is they're outside of school for about 5 days on average, and they are much more likely to self-identify problems because they're not in the environment in which they have to show up as a certain persona that they've developed in school. So really, that's the key to it. They're getting assessed. Most of them have never had services before, and they're getting plugged into services in the community.
So do you track participants after they complete the program? And if so, have you found this, you know, what's the turning point for some?
So we do track them. There's a 30-day follow-up with the schools. I'd say more than 50% are doing well. Some come back through PASS. They can rotate back through a second time. A third time they can come through, as long as there's some evidence that the recommendations that were made have been at least somewhat followed. So there is that kind of coming back to school. And the question we pose to them is, how are you going to show up differently in the hallways when you go back to school? Because school's not going to change.
Right. All right, Daniel, let's talk about the Recovery Build Alternative Peer Group. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the APG Alternative Peer Group program is actually a partnership with Stephanie's BHI program. Stephanie kind of brought Duffy Health Center into it as a clinical partner back in 2018. And the way that the program is designed is to support adolescents ages 13 to 17 who are experiencing substance use disorder in a really meaningful way that includes a lot of psychoeducation, support, counseling, treatment for their substance use itself, paired with trying to figure out how do you incorporate fun and positive lifestyle changes into creating health and wellness. So the program started originally as a very sleepy program where it was two part-time staff members who were supporting a handful of kids on Cape Cod. It has really expanded over the past few years to kind of branch out into two physical sites, one in Dennis and one in Falmouth, where at any point in time we can be serving up to 12 unique adolescents at each site. So for a total of 24 folks. The way that it works is it's kind of an after-school resource running from about 3:30 to 5:30 twice a week for each site, with again the intention of having one of the nights be a clinical night where again, the participants can come in, explore, learn, etc. And then the other night is let's go out or do something that's really enjoyable and fun. So kind of pairing it. What's really lovely about this program is that it incorporates a full-time therapist, behavioral health specialist, recovery coach, family support specialist, and hopefully soon to be an outreach case manager, with the hope of creating a care continuum for about 6 months or so, to support discussions with school and returning to the community and creating milestones. And then the final thing I will say is we operate from a multiple pathways and harm reduction model. So the goal isn't to tell our participants that they need to be abstinent, that they need to stop what they're doing, right? We want to figure out what are the goals that you have for yourself that could be related to your substance use, it could be related to sports, it could be related to academics, it could be related to a whole variety of things. And how do we support you with getting to those goals? Because often what we see is that as our participants are hitting those milestones that they and their caregivers have created, it provides positive secondary gains for their substance use. And we see those kind of patterns shift in a really, really positive way.
So, Daniel, so harm reduction for people aren't understanding. You're not asking them to become sober. You're asking them to reduce whatever their use is. So tell us how that philosophy works, because you get they see the benefits, right, of some of the of cutting down on whatever they're doing. Does that lead them to sobriety?
So, I will say this, harm reduction gets a bad rap. Mindy, you know me well enough to know that I don't sugarcoat stuff. And I will say that I think that there's this negative narrative that if you are operating from a harm reduction lens, you're promoting substance use. Not the case,
No,
right? What
right.
we're trying to do is to figure out, okay, if someone presents to us who is a young person who is using alcohol, using marijuana, using nicotine, maybe dabbling with press pills or stimulants or whatever it is, like let's start somewhere, right? So maybe the conversation starting point is, hey, we've noticed that again, one of your goals is that you want to be in theater. Great. How do we get you there? Well, it looks like maybe purchasing and buying these stimulants or these pills is your biggest deterrent from being able to be successful with moving forward, right? So we're not going to say stop everything that you're doing, but how about if we try to, what about if you use, less of this or shift this or do that, right? It's providing a lot of education and support, and recognizing that the teens that are in this program, they're not stupid,
Right.
right? We have incredibly brilliant minds that are coming to these groups. So being able to educate them and allow them to have agency and autonomy in making decisions that are going to promote their health and wellness is where the change happens, because I think we're all tired of being told what to do, but when we're able to be a part of the solution or a part of the plans for next steps, it's an incredibly empowering phenomena. So, and it moves folks away from just this sobriety mentality to how do you build a functioning life where you can do what you want to do and follow what you desire to do, and how do we adjust the external things that may be impacting that to see that positivity.
Yeah, Rachel, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, work in tandem with what David is saying. The programming prior to my position here, I was in the high school for 2.5 years, working with the most acute cases of mental illness, dual diagnosis. But in that, in following up on what David is saying, this concept, right, of pursuit rather than avoidance, we just know that doesn't that barely works with adults. It certainly doesn't work with me. And so if it's framed in a way that says you are if you, these steps will be in pursuit of what you want, that is a much more sustainable a motivator than being in avoidance of what you don't want, right? So then we do it in my method has always been value domain work in this, and I just design it like a March Madness bracket, and the end would be whatever the value is, and then there's a couple goals that feed the value, and there's some action items that feed the goals, right? But what it is the autonomy that David's talking about, right? We know, bless her heart, Nancy Reagan, but we know Just Say No didn't work. It didn't work, right? It's telling someone what not to do, which is it doesn't stick, certainly when someone doesn't have a lot of foresight, which is just where their brains are. However, if it's framed in a way that you are in pursuit of such and such, and these are the action items and the goals that get you there, that is when we have the better outcome. So I couldn't agree more with what David is, I'm sorry, Daniel. I'm sorry, Daniel. My apologies, Daniel. What Daniel is talking about in this approach of this risk, the harm reduction that comes from saying, what do you want, kiddo? We're gonna help you to identify that and walk toward it.
So, David, I know that some of your students have participated in the alternative peer group. Talk a little bit about the impact of that.
Well, there's a therapeutic impact, and then there's a practical impact. I am responsible for grades 10 through 12. And then I have a colleague who handles grades 8 and 9. And we always recommend that students go for the full 5 days. And the practical impact is they get a break. I think there's a lot to be said for changing the routine a little bit. Obviously, that's a big impact on depression and anxiety, just on a what you're seeing. So they get a bit of a break. It's the small group setting. I don't think we've had any kid go that didn't want to go back or stay there. I mean, the Cape Cod Pass is a wonderful program when kids are coming back and giving that feedback.
Yeah, and that gets other kids. Stephanie, before we went on there, you were telling me kids tell other kids, and then they're like, "I want to go," right?
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. Angela, what about on the Vineyard? Do you have similar programs for teens on the Vineyard?
So on the Vineyard, we have a very similar idea that punitive punishment does not work. Positive reinforcement, identifying goals are the way to go. We've partnered with I Decide through Mass General, which is a very motivating, empowering program for individuals. We have recovery coaches in the school. We promote positive social norms. So just like Rachel was pointing out, telling people what not to do hasn't been advantageous and successful. So let's identify that the majority of kids aren't vaping. Let's identify what the major amount of students are doing versus what we don't want them to be doing. And then we also have just worked really hard to educate the students and the parents in order to promote well-being overall. And just like David was saying, we are seeing this trend towards reducing the stigma associated with substance use disorder. Three seniors in our capstone project this year in the high school specifically worked on reducing the stigma around substance use disorder. So there's a lot of positive movement in terms of reducing substance use disorder and promoting well-being.
Let's talk about stigma for a second, because you might be right, we're reducing, but there's still a lot of stigma around this, right? And there's still a lot of, I'm sure, Stephanie, you've had this with parents who, it's like, we don't talk about family business outside of family, right? I mean, that stigma is still there for some.
Sure. Understandably, parents don't want to admit there might be a problem with their child in any regard, but particularly substance use. They again, understandably feel like it reflects poorly on them and their upbringing. So there's a lot to be said for family programs. And I know Danny talked about the APG family support person there. It's really critical to be looking at the whole family system and focusing on elevating the wellness of all of them so that the teen or the young person can actually sustain and maintain their recovery goals.
Yes. That was one of the things I wanted to ask you, Danny, is like this importance of including family members. That's huge.
It is. It's pivotal, right? Because what I feel is that if we are working with these adolescents in this clinical setting, you know, that only goes so far, right? We know that long-term changes and lifestyle changes happen outside of the four walls of a clinic or a treatment space. So being able to include family in on that and have them support what the treatment plan is, but also be very open and vocal about what concerns they have and what desires they wish, and trying to kind of get those goals to align. So then that way it's not, you know, a teen competing with their caregiver. It is how do we create shared values and goals here? That's huge. Yeah. What I do want to say though, Mindy, is stigma is still an incredible, incredible issue. I do know that what we hear often, especially for individuals who are prospectively referring to the alternative peer group, is caregivers who are saying, my children aren't that bad, right? So why would I put them into a program where they're going to be around other kids who are going to be worse, right? We hear that. We hear actually community partners who at face value say, yes, we need to do prevention work for adolescents. We need to educate our kids. We need to create these programs. But keep them away from the general population, right? We had the reason why we're in private offices now is because we used to have a collaborative space in a very community-based location on Cape Cod. And we were told, I think we're going to move your location to the attic space because we want to get them away from the other kids, right? So that is where there is some dissonance, right? We need to figure out how do we promote, educate, talk about this in a very non-stigmatizing way when there is still going to be this kind of underlay of anyone who uses substances is bad.
Right.
Those are bad kids, right? Yeah. That is not the reality.
Yep.
And so we need to figure out as a community, regionally and nationally, how we approach that.
Yeah, Rachel?
Yeah, again, you know, Danny's spot on in every single word that comes out. And then the piece I wanted to add to that is regionally, where we are, Cape and Islands, right? We know that we have a higher concentration of immigrant populations who may come from cultures that are less receptive to mental health intervention, less receptive to other people coming in, as you said, Mindy, about, you know, people on the outside coming into their family. And so there's this cultural competency piece that, you know, we're all aware of. And I do believe that every entity is frantically working to catch up. Everybody knows about it. It's just, but we're not, doesn't mean we're there yet, right? Mm-hmm. It certainly has resources deplete and go in the other direction. But the cultural competency piece, given our region, from the simplest being a language barrier, all the way up to how do you approach people from different cultures, different family backgrounds, to say you're not broken or wrong, you know, and not everybody's going to know your business. How do we gain that trust? So it's not as though we've solved that problem and have all the answers, but it is very in front of our faces, and we are all trying to figure out how to get over that hump.
Yeah. David, you wanted to add something? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think there's some other pieces, too, that I've found helpful. One is the really good work that people like Lisa McGillicuddy are doing with DBT training for people. Concepts like, you know, being present for kids and having radical acceptance for behaviors that are going on now and realizing that they're not going to continue in the future allows parents to control what they can control, and then also maintains that relationship, which can be really hard when people are struggling. And, you know, too often I see that in my line of work where the first reaction is frustration, and then it's anger, and then we're not going down a good path. But eventually, I like to call it the erosion technique. You kind of just wear people down to get them where you think they need the most support. And then the other part that I would add too that's been very helpful is the partnership with Outer Cape Health Services. We have in-school therapists now working out of our library to help with the waiting list and the, absolutely frustrating situation with the lack of psychiatrists and certified therapists here on the Cape. I think the last time I saw the ratio for patients to psychiatrists, it was 17 to 1, and that was a year or two ago. And those are the folks that really should be prescribing medications to help with all these issues, and that's a whole nother thing. But I think between Cape Cod Pass, from the school point of view, between Cape Cod Pass working with Outer Cape Health, having Outer Cape Health therapy in school, we're cutting a lot of these institutional challenges for people out of the way and cutting, the wait down to get that help that's usually recommended when a child attends PASS.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll take a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about regional programs for teens with substance use disorder and how collaborations among healthcare providers, schools, and behavioral health professionals can create opportunities for kids. With us, Daniel Rodriguez, Director of Substance Use Disorder and Outreach Programs at Duffy Health Center. Stephanie Brietti, she's co-founder and CEO of Behavioral Health Innovators. Angela Knapp, Executive Director of Martha's Vineyard Youth Task Force. Rachel Merriweathers, Director of Clinical Operations at Fairwinds, Nantucket's Behavioral Health Center. And David Alexander's Assistant Principal at Monomoy Regional High School. For some of these kids, substance use is multi-generational. Are you seeing instances where parents or grandparents are seeking supports for their substance use because they're part of the program for their teen? Anybody seeing that?
I know at APG we have. Danny, you want to take that one?
Sure, I can definitely start. Yes, I would say that as our family support specialist has gone in, because that work does not happen in the clinical space, that is in homework. Oftentimes, a lot of patterns, behaviors, and just like family dynamics wash out during that those sessions. And the way that we design the work is to have the family support specialist begin with caregivers, better understand them, their history, what their desires are, and then being able to draw in the adolescent or the participant. And what we have seen is a willingness at times for families to change some of their own use of substances in the household. Maybe you have a caregiver who is more of a drinker on the weekends or whatever, who may actually reduce risk for their adolescent by reducing their own use. We also have had families who, going back to the mental health comorbidities, maybe they have some stuff that they need to work on from their own upbringing, and have shown a willingness to connect to their own community resources, whether that be support groups or their own therapist or longer term family therapy. So there is a lot of positive gains with being able to collaborate and to address substance use, not as a singular model, but recognizing that, again, it's beyond just the person at the center. It's family, it's systems, it's community, it's culture. And as folks are able to dip their toes into those conversations, we do see some positivity.
Yeah. How about denial? How do you deal with denial? You know, Stephanie, you mentioned some parents don't want to sometimes face the fact that their child might have this issue. And I can just think years back, I knew one of the resource officers at the high school, and she would say, she'd tell parents about, a kid who she caught using marijuana, and they'd be like, oh, it's just a little marijuana. Or, the kids just drink at home. I'd rather have them home drinking than out drinking. So how do you deal with that when you have a child who may be, looking for help, but parents are in denial about that? Oh, David has his hand up. Go ahead, David.
I think one of the things that's changed with the now legalization of marijuana is that everybody thinks it's a panacea for anxiety and depression, when in fact it's the opposite.
Right.
And I recall one day where, this was several years ago, where we had multiple reentry meetings for suspensions revolving around drugs. And every single parent in those meetings said, we know they're doing it. It helps them. And that was heartbreaking because we all know where that leads.
So David,
really
when you're
solving any problems.
David, let me ask you, when you have that, do you present them with the research that shows otherwise? How do you deal with that?
My response is always the same way, whatever it is, when I'm dealing with, you know, we're a student-centered school, and so the approach is always transparent with our concerns. And my response in those cases is always, I have to respectfully disagree with you. This is a depressant, and this is going to get worse before it gets better if we don't take some more, I guess, whatever you want to call it, appropriate steps. But that's a frustration because the mindset around marijuana is all messed up.
Yeah. Rachel? You know?
It is a matter of education around the uncooked brain, as we say, right? Because this is just something that is not necessarily innate knowledge. Where would someone know this unless they came across it? Not to mention the fact that we call 18 an adult when we all know that that is just a weird number to come up with. and we know about the neuroscience behind the brain's executive functioning and developing and not being ready to really call itself developed until, 25, we could say, right? But the some of the instances that I have been around, personally witnessed and then heard from colleagues, it is something that is a lack of understanding and knowledge. We will have parents from their own mouth, in front of a room of mandated reporters, DCF involved, say that they give gummies, to their child to help with their teen, to help with anxiety. To help, they get so anxious before coming to school. So that's how much they don't know. They just put themselves in a position to be filed on, and nobody would do that on purpose. And that is really it. It's the lack of understanding of what it really is,
right,
and the impact it will have on their child's brain.
Danny?
And what I'd like to add is a couple layers here. I just want to start by saying that oftentimes all of this decision making is around love, right? And I think that if we don't honor that and recognize it, then we're starting from a deficit. We have broken systems, right? We all talked a little bit today about the lack of care and resources. David talked about how, they're doing more in-school interventions because there's a lack of providers and there's a lack of treatment. And a lot of those treatments have been designed in a way that aren't very encompassing or responsive to teens and families and systems and all that stuff. So we're kind of working against a broken system to begin with. When I think about denial, what I also think about is every conversation that we have with a participant or their caregivers needs to be done from a non-judgmental standpoint where there's a ton of curiosity, right? So being able to dig further beyond saying this is right or wrong, but what do you think? Why do you feel that way? What is your interpretation of this? What do you see? What do you see that result impacting your child or yourself, right? So rather than, again, coming in with this bravado, just being able to have really intimate conversations. So then that way parents and their children can feel as though they're present and they're put into the center. And then the final thing I'll say is really recognizing that where there is denial, sometimes positive challenging of those statements can be really helpful, where I can recall a family that were really actually on the other side of the spectrum, incredibly concerned about their children's use pattern. And knowing the bigger picture and what other children are experiencing, it was very minimal. And actually the challenge of denial was conversations around, do you remember when you were a kid? Like, what was that like? You know what I mean? Like, I'm pretty confident we've all done some pretty weird things as adolescents and probably attempted or tried or whatever. So being able to not normalize it, but to bring in their experiences that get lost in the annals of their memories actually has a really great therapeutic value.
Yeah. Really quick, Stephanie.
I would add, you have to come at it more than once too with the family, and they have to hear it more than one time in this show and all the other events that are out there that you can come to hear about it, encourage people to come to it. They have to hear it more than once.
All right. We're going to put a link with more information at our website. Daniel Rodriguez, Stephanie Brietti, Angela Knapp, Rachel Merriweather, and David Alexander, thank you all for being here, and thank you for the work that you do. It's so important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you so much, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Everybody.